I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Evany Rosen joins me now. The comedian has just published a marvelous collection, What I Think Happened, an Under-Researched History of the Western World. It has so many laugh-out-loud moments, and it's a terrific introduction to various aspects of history by a self-described failed academic. Too much of history isn't written considering the feminist perspective, and this book rectifies that. With scathing, hilarious, and often remarkable insight, Ms. Rosen recasts her understanding of the monarchy, Napoleon, American presidents, and all the other things we're told are important but really don't know much about. The book is the inaugural publication of the new Robin's Egg imprint at Arsenal Pulp Press, books curated and edited by our friend Charlie Demers. There is an event this Saturday, the 4th of November, at Little Mountain Gallery. That's at 8 p.m., Evany, Charlie, and a slew of local talents will be performing, and you'll be able to buy this book and meet its author. It's a terrific achievement. Please welcome to the Planta Online program, Evany Rosen. Ms. Rosen, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Pretty good yourself.
Good, thanks.
So as I was telling you just before we started, I really enjoyed this book. Do you worry that for some readers this might be the only time that they'll encounter people like Millard Fillmore or Henry VIII or even Napoleon?
I'm really not worried ever about anyone encountering Millard Fillmore, to be honest.
Yeah.
And I guess my hope is that if people haven't encountered those figures, that encountering them here in this kind of light way makes them want to learn more.
Yeah, that's what happened to me as I'm reading the book, because one realizes just the gaps that they have in their knowledge. What I need to read to fill those in. But in the meantime, God, what a ride this is. This is such a funny and it's entertaining, obviously, but it also informs us in the sense that history does have these blind spots. And you're marvelous in the sense that you are able to shine the light on these things that we know about that aren't really the full picture of what happened.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm so glad that was your takeaway from it. That's the ideal takeaway, as opposed to just someone being like, "This what?"
Yeah.
So I'm glad.
Yeah, I mean, I can see how a lot of people are bored by history, but you do it in such an engaging and interesting way. Where does your own interest, where does that come from?
Well, I talk about this at the end of the book, but it definitely comes a lot from my dad, who's sort of a historical hobbyist like I am. So we would go on a lot of road trips through the States, especially, and through New England, and I would learn about stuff from him. It was always about being kind of on site at a historical location and learning about it through the kind of story of that place, because he's such a good narrative storyteller,
uh-huh.
that it really, for me, made history about a collection of stories and about people. And I think that's where it becomes interesting, as opposed to this thing that's so separate from us and it's just a series of dates and events that we can't connect to.
There are different kinds of history dads, though. I mean, and you write in the book the kind of stereotypes that there are out there.
Yes, I think dads in general love history, and there are different types. My dad's kind of a cross-section of all three that I mentioned in the book.
And the way that they view history, I mean, it reflects on the people around them, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I think when we look at history, at least the way I like to look at it, your own personality ends up informing which of history's many personalities kind of draw you in.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think history is just full of personalities, and it can have that so much. And if we look at it that way, suddenly that's where we can find the humor in it and the human interest.
Now, history is constantly being rewritten, but the feminist perspective, that's always left out. Why do you think that is, and do you think that'll change anytime soon?
I think we're seeing it change as we speak. I think less and less we're hearing history from kind of the mainstream white male narrative, so to speak.
Yeah.
Not that it's always that, but I think we're starting to definitely hear histories from other genders, from other cultures, from other places, and different reads even on our own history that come from those. I think that we're very much in a time of change for that right now.
Yeah.
But it can be interesting to go back to that kind of mainstream history and look at it from another lens.
Yeah. So when you're seeing certain places take down, say, Confederate statues. Is there any part of you that says that maybe that shouldn't happen?
No, I think it's hard to disagree with the impetus behind the rage that there is about the Civil War and the reverence that we place kind of on both sides. And I've had to rethink my own narrative of how I learned about the Civil War, because I've always been fascinated by the Civil War and obviously always felt that my views and opinions of it were on the correct side of history. But sometimes you still get an education about it that's a bit like, well, the South weren't doing the right thing, but what a noble guy, you know, Robert E. Lee was, et cetera. And as you start to hear that through African-American and female narratives and other narratives, you realize we're still placing way too much reverence on someone that was on an ultimately villainous side of history, regardless of his sort of Southern genteelness.
There's a section in here about presidents, and I'm fascinated by presidents, so you'll indulge me for a minute here about, because I can't get out of my head Jerry. Which is the name that Warren Harding gave his penis, and I've never thought of another guy's penis before like this. You know what I mean? So
no, I don't. Yeah, I've never met anyone who names their penis, let alone a name that was not their own name.
And so, I mean, you look at American presidents, and we obviously are living through a very remarkable time with the current president.
No kidding.
Yeah, when you see how there are 45 of these guys who become president of the United States, does the narrative make sense that we end up with Donald Trump today?
That's an interesting one. It's hard. Sometimes I find when you go back and start looking at presidents, it can be hard to find any kind of logical through line. There's an overall kind of cultural through line of America and how it's teetered toward its current state. But there are so many weird blip presidents along the way, many of whom are mentioned in that chapter in this book, which is called America's Jumpiest Presidents. You know, and guys that just chose not to run for re-election or who kind of dropped dead partway through and didn't make a huge impact. So I think we often chart the American presidencies through these 15, you know, big guys that we remember. Yeah. And then we sort of forget to go like, I wonder how Garfield kind of affected the narrative and how much that plays presently now. But I certainly think there's an egomania to the American dream that has evolved in a way that I'm horrified but not totally surprised to see where it's ended up.
I think now that we think about it, it's not a surprise that he's president today.
It isn't.
Yeah.
And that the country was founded under kind of this duress during the American Revolution, and that certain things, like the need for militias and the right to bear arms, were so much involved in the founding of the country that those narratives somehow shockingly remained.
You know, I mentioned Harding. He traveled in Alaska, and then he went through Vancouver on his way down to San Francisco, where he ended up. So a lot of people in this part of the world think that because of his proclivities for romance outside of his marriage, he may have been poisoned by his wife. I mean, do you buy into that in his demise? And because I mean, he was, you talk about these love letters that he wrote. He was a bit of a dirtbag. Well, he was a dirtbag, wasn't he?
He was a dirtbag. Yeah, and not just sexually, but also just was a terrible president. Took a lot of bribes. The man was just an asshole. I wonder if his wife poisoned him. I do think, if she did, I do think it's very funny that he died in bed while making her read him a positive review about his presidency in the Evening Post, rather. So if she did poison him, that must have been a very satisfying moment for her.
I don't know much about Napoleon, other than he's short, and in reading the book, I guess I need to know more about him. What do you want readers to know more about Napoleon?
Well, I just think if you're a fan of popular culture today, and I mentioned briefly this in the chapter about Napoleon, if you're sort of fascinated by the way people like Kanye West or Taylor Swift kind of model their images and the kind of larger-than-life PR efforts that surround people like that, which I find very fascinating, then Napoleon is the place to start. Because he was the first kind of freak PR genius.
Yeah.
And I find that so fascinating.
And you studied him in school, is that right?
I studied him in school, yeah, here and there. I remember I had a high school English teacher that was really into Napoleon, and that was part of what started my strange and lifelong obsession.
So at the book's core is your own infectious interest of these various aspects of history, and that it is important to know stuff. And I guess for far too long, a lot of us have been ignorant about different aspects of history, and we shouldn't be any longer. Are you hopeful that because of, say, what's happening in the news, that will, say, inspire people to learn about these aspects of history that they have gaps in?
Yeah, I hope so. Certainly not in a dogmatic way, because I don't have enough academic authority in this book, as readers will quickly discover, to be able to say how much we all really need to learn about history, like I have. But my hope is that because our own histories can shed such a light on our present circumstances in any time, that a book like this will allow history to feel a little more familiar and friendly, at least as a subject matter, if not in terms of its subject, so that we don't feel so intimidated by traveling backwards and looking at where we've come from and all the things we've done, good and mostly bad.
Yeah, well, there are patterns, aren't there, of history, and far too well. I mean, I think we know that, but we overlook that, and we repeat a lot of the bad stuff.
Yeah, I think that's a big kind of lesson to be learned, and of course there's a lot of historiographical debate about whether we should look at history cyclically or narratively or in isolated pockets, but I do think it's hard to ignore, just from a psychological standpoint, that there are certain facets to human nature that have always been true, regardless of where our technology is at or our religious beliefs are at, that creates a kind of cyclical nature to how we move through time.
Yeah, and I mean, when we encounter Nazism today and fascism, I mean, there's a chapter in the book about how we view Nazis. We're encountering that today, aren't we, in the discourse?
Yeah, I'm shocked that they're, I mean, I think we're all shocked that they're back in a way, because Nazis always existed as the kind of ultimate bad guy in history that we point to. But there's a humor in how we point to them in a way, because I think they feel like such a freak product of the past, and obviously that was becoming very clear that that's not true. They're still a very present, very real, very terrifying group.
How much of our conception of history is shaped by movies?
I think a huge amount.
Yeah.
Because I think if we talk about, you know, history coming alive in this way, that suddenly it becomes a collection of human interest stories and personalities and real people. We are able to connect to that so much more quickly when they're portrayed for us on film and we see an actor that we know portraying a fully formed version of a character from history. That suddenly becomes so much more real than just hearing a series of dates and things that they did, because we get to learn their personality that way, even if they're, you know, sensationalized or whatever for the screen, depending on who's making the movie.
Yeah, I mean, I had so many people that are interested in Lincoln think he's Daniel Day-Lewis or vice versa, right?
It's true. Everyone's just imagining Sally Fields as Mary Todd Lincoln. Thrill Sally Fields.
Yeah. Did you always want to be a comedian? Say, growing up, was that what you wanted to do?
No, I thought I wanted to be a professor. I thought I wanted to be an academic. I always did comedy. You know, I did, you know, improv classes as a teen and stuff. And I always was a performer, so a hammy kid. But I really thought I was going to go off to King's College in Halifax and be, you know, an academic and a professor, because I'd always had this kind of casual love of history through my dad. And then I arrived there and realized I was absolutely not cut out to do that in any way, shape, or form. And had started doing comedy kind of simultaneously with starting my degree. And by the end of by the time I staggered to the finish line in my fifth year of my degree, I realized that I was meant to go another way, and that my comedy career was going a lot better than my academic one.
Yeah. What? Who are some of the people that you watch, say, growing up, that you really admire or emulate?
That's always, like, comedically, you mean? Yeah, I always find that question tough to answer, because I think I definitely grew up watching Saturday Night Live. I remembered and it speaks to the book, actually. I remember watching with my dad. We somehow got a hold of a DVD copy of Dress to Kill, which is an Eddie Izzard special. And I remember that really impacting me because he was also talking about history in this comedic sort of way that made it so exciting. I remember that really stuck with me. And that he did it all in drag. I just thought, who is this man? I was so fascinated by him. Mm-hmm. But then also, I think as a character comedian, a lot of my influence doesn't come necessarily from other comedians, but from watching different spheres of influence that then you turn into comedy. Mm. So I often joke about this with my comedy partner, Kayla Lorette, who's featured in the book. She and I both were so influenced when we were young by any films about kind of an aging actress or star who goes insane. This is my favorite narrative. You know, Sunset Boulevard, Baby Jane, yeah. All About Eve, and these kinds of things had just as much of an influence on me as my comedic influences. The characters that are just sort of older, difficult women have been my favorite to play always.
Yeah. And that comes through in your writing, doesn't it? I mean, it's a sort of, I don't give a shit about what you think about, or this is what I think the history is about, or this figure is about.
Yeah, the joy of this kind of confidently scattered, dramatically wrong kind of narrative is very delightful to me, yeah. And a fun way to write.
Yeah, there's not enough comedy in print, is there?
I think we're seeing more and more. I think it's so exciting that so this book is being published by Arsenal Paul Press out in Vancouver, but yeah. It's under the imprint Robin's Egg, yeah. And this is the first book for Robin's Egg, which my editor and friend and a very brilliant comedian, Charles Damaris, has started.
Yeah.
So I think pockets like that are coming out more and more, so we're going to start to see more and more humor essay books, which is exciting.
Yeah, because it's a lot of the memoirs that we get are of comedians and their lives or their experiences, but you do it in a way. I mean, we do get to know you a little bit as we're reading this book, but it really is about these historical figures and these events in history. With this perspective, that's really funny. You know, it's a new sort of genre almost. What was it like to work with Charlie?
It was great. I mean, we had been friends for a long time, and I had always admired his books. Mm-hmm. And then I was actually doing stand up opening for one of his for the book launch of The Horrors out in Toronto, and he sort of half jokingly was like, "You should write a book," and I was sort of like, "Haha." Mm-hmm, of course not. And then it sort of evolved, and it became clear that he was serious,
yeah.
Which was so exciting. I was so honored that he kind of picked me to write his first book for this imprint, especially because, you know, I was a writer, and I was a television writer, but I didn't really have a body of prose that spoke to the fact that I would be able to do this. So he really took a chance on me, sort of based on just my stand-up. And then it speaks to what you said about this book not being a comedic memoir, only in that it wasn't that I went to Charlie and said, "I want to write a book of humor essays about history." Charlie came to me and said, "Do you want to write a book of humor essays about whatever you want?"
Yeah.
And I said, "Of course." That was such an exciting opportunity, but then it was kind of overwhelming because I didn't have a pitch, I didn't have an idea. And I sort of talked with my close friends and with him and kind of racked my brain about what this book of humor essays could be about. And I didn't feel like as a 30-year-old Canadian, I really had enough life or professional experience to fill a book in a compelling way. And then I realized, well, why don't you write about something that feels like a failure in my own life in a fun way, because I sort of had this failed academic career. And I thought, oh, what a fun, glorious kind of return to that could be, and how much I would enjoy getting to do the research and delving back into history in this way.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like you had a lot. I mean, even just the footnotes themselves are worth reading. You must have had fun doing this, did you?
I had so much fun. It was a wild experience because I was still, you know, working at the same time with my other jobs and writing on shows. So it was complicated to fit writing this book in between my other work, because as comedians, we got to wear a lot of hats.
Yeah.
I do voice work. I write scripts. So it was managing all of that while focusing so much on the book. But it was so joyful to write. I had such a good time writing it, which I hope comes out you read it.
It does, yeah. And you're looking forward to being in Vancouver this weekend?
Yes, I'm very much looking forward. I love visiting Vancouver. And I'm very excited for the launch at Little Mountain on Saturday. We have a lot of wonderful guests joining us. Mm-hmm. And that'll be really fun. It's going to be a little more interactive than a normal book launch. So there's a chapter, for example, called The Founding Fathers, an Imagined Oral History,
yeah.
that we're going to do with some local comedians, like a live sketch reading, which will be very fun.
Oh, man.
And then a lot of my friends, there's a well-known improv troupe in Vancouver called The Sunday Service,
right.
who I'm privileged to be longtime friends with.
Yeah.
So they're going to be performing with me on Saturday, and I'm going to be performing on their show on Sunday. Very excited.
Yeah, and I was reading up on that. It's a free event.
It's a free event.
Yeah.
There's nothing to stop you.
Yeah, and people can get this book. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you, Evany. I really hope this book does well for you, because you're a voice that we need more of, and you're just so damned entertaining and funny about it, and people learn something too along the way. So congratulations and good luck with this book.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it, and it was a pleasure talking with you.